So, good evening, everybody. I'm Martin Siras, I'm the director here at the center, and it's a great pleasure that we show a ugly car on the with all due respect to Toyota. But no, it's great to be able to introduce Anthony. I think I'm myself very excited to hear all the great news and new stories that he will share with us. I think this is what the meetup for us is all about: is to show open innovation, show that we're here to work together with everybody to create autonomous vehicles and make that a reality in the world. And I hope first here in the Bay Area. And I asked Anthony a couple of months ago, and he said, "Sure, I'll come." And, then I called him up, and he said, "Still, sure, I'll come."
This morning when you should.
Yeah, 100 people coming for you, right? It's pretty cool. No, but so the thing is that Anthony is, so trying to find a bio online for you is like searching, Google doesn't have much out of you. I don't know what it is. But, the wonderful thing is that he's from a country where, dear to my heart. And I don't know if you're actually originally from Belgium or...
Born in Brussels, yeah.
Yeah, born in Brussels. So so that's great. We have two Europeans here running the autonomous vehicle show. That's wonderful. But he also is very well known for having the Ghost Rider at the Dark Grand Challenge. Not a car, but a motorcycle. So it shows. And then what I really started. You're also an entrepreneur from a very young age. So he's a man of many trades. And to me, it shows like the spirit of what we're trying to do here. So without further ado, Anthony, I hope you can get a standing ovation.
All right. First off, I'm here personally and not representing Google. I'll be talking about the project that we're coming to Google, but don't take this as Google's official
speech. Yes, we will.
I'm really fortunate to be here. So please interrupt with questions as you want. I'm welcome to take questions afterwards too, but they're always good case for this. So self-driving cars, it's kind of not a new idea. It's not the first time that people imagine this. This is a 50s and people have cars. Everybody's always wanted, hey, I want to play, autos, They didn't anticipate the iPad or, smartphones or things like this, but, they realized that the spending time in a car is not always pleasurable. And they didn't anticipate traffic, which I would say is a little bit of an issue.
Where did you get the picture? Is that
actually
from the 50s?
Yeah, it is. So this is an advertisement from, I think, Popular Mechanics from 1957 from America's Power Companies. And they were advising, saying in 10 years, America's highways would be powered by electricity and the cars would drive themselves. And so, we're here, and, now people are still saying in 10 years, things are going to be like this. But I think this time is actually real. Things are going to be happening because the technology wasn't quite there, the ideas were there, and now we're going to plug the gas there. So how do we get there? So we've got kind of really good demonstrations. This is showing a little picture of a demonstration that UC Berkeley and Carnegie Mellon did for automated highways back in 97, I think. 8 cars following, within 1 or 2 meters of each other, going full speed ahead. But the problem there was that you had infrastructure issue. So to make this work, you needed little magnets in every single row. And we don't even have money to fill the potholes or paint the ground. How are we going to put magnets for cars that don't really have it yet? So one of the philosophies that we had in thinking about this project is, how do we make something that doesn't require to have any infrastructure changes? Because that takes a long time, and it requires people to think ahead and really want to create a barrier to somebody putting a new technology out, because they're not going to do it until the infrastructure is there. The second barrier in our mind is the chicken and egg issue. So there's some great demonstrations of platooning where you have a professional driver, somebody that's certified in this, they drive 500,000 miles a year, they're much safer than any of us here at driving. And then you can have your car and you can kind of zoom up behind it. And then you can have hands-free, feet-free driving and kind of enjoy the drive to work behind the semi. From my personal take, this is very difficult because A, I don't necessarily want to drive behind a semi on my whole way to the commute. B, I don't necessarily want to have to coordinate with another vehicle and say, hey, I want to be the same place at the same time and hook up, right? That's hard enough to do when I'm meeting somebody in a fixed location. Imagine doing that dynamically on the highway. So for that, we created, you know, a vehicle that as Martin pointed out, is ugly. We've managed to make it ugly by adding a bunch of extra, you know, junk on it. But it's pretty basic again, I think. You know, there's a laser, C360 around the car. I see Wolfgang here from the representative of the Palladyne that makes the sensor that we use. There's also a bunch of cameras behind the windshield that actually help us see where the traffic lights are, turn signals, as well as radars that are on the vehicle that help to see the speeds and distances of vehicles. And so with that, you know, we have a computer that does all the processing. We still have four wheels, so which is actually key, because if you try to do on two wheels, it's a little bit tougher, which I'll show you guys a little bit later. But the idea is we try to raise the bar of the technology that needs to be added to the vehicle, so that anybody that has this vehicle by themselves doesn't need another vehicle to drive them, or doesn't need special infrastructure to have them driven. And that's really important, because the first person that has this should be able to get benefits and not necessarily wait for everybody to have it before it becomes harmful. So, you know, as we operate these vehicles on the road, we want to, you know, simulate real driving conditions. So I'll tell you a little bit about our training pipeline. How do we train our test drivers? You know, imagine, you know, what does it take to actually go and pilot one of these vehicles? So we actually have two different kind of thoughts on how we train drivers. We train them for freeway driving or for surface street driving. And what we do is we have basically multiple levels. And from, you know, having a person being checked out on the street, from having a person going through co-driver, so meaning they're sitting in the right seat of the car looking what computers are doing. We first do this with an instructor, and then they have some tests, then we take them offline for a third-party driving test, meaning they're able to do reactive tests, make sure what their reflexes are, and learning how to handle a vehicle in an emergency situation. And then there's a bunch of different tests they go through. So it's a 13 kind of step process to understand how to do the full step driving. I'll talk a little bit about how our user interface works, because I think it's really important to kind of people understand what it's like to have a car. So kind of what I'll talk about here, so when you're driving a car manually, first of all, the car doesn't work on every street. It needs to know where it needs to drive by being tied to a map. That's basically saying, on northbound 101 today, lane 1, 2, and 3, you can drive in, but lane 4, you can't. If you're in lane 4, you have the first screen, which is manual, which is basically showing you kind of like how fast you're going. A very standard setup. Then as you enter a road that you're kind of able to drive, the thought is you're still driving in manual, and you need to have the vehicle be able to warm you up and say, like, hey, I'm ready to be able to take control from you. This is showing you kind of a ready screen, which basically is saying, hey, you now actually have the system believes it is capable to safely drive, and saying, if you want to, I can do it. And as you press the button, yeah.
What you're saying, these are screens that are part of the infotainment system?
Yeah, so we don't have it part of the infotainment system, but we have it as a driver display that's kind of located in your field of view. Kind of imagine where like your heads-up display would be, kind of at the base of the windshield. It's a way that as you're driving, you would normally see through, but this is kind of slightly below. So if it's a dark screen, you can see the speedometer. And if it starts to light up blue, you're like, oh, it's ready to go. I can press the button. You don't actually have to read it. You can be trained, because blue is the only state that you'll see that in. And then as you engage, we kind of have the thought of having a binary system where either you're driving and you're responsible because you're the next driver, or the system is driving. And it's very important to be able to distinguish between that, because one of the things that we've seen in many accidents, not from us driving, but in the real world, especially in the aviation industry, is you have the pilot thinking that the computer's driving, and you have the computer thinking that the pilot's driving. Yeah, we don't know how what happened at the Asiana flight or a bunch of Air France crashes, but the idea here is that confusion about who's in charge and who's actually driving is very important, something to be able to look at. So what we want to have is for you to be conscious that you're in manual and then it's blue and say, I'm ready for you. When you press the button, if it takes over from you, it will show you a green screen. So you'll be like, oh, I got a proper transition. Or if you got a red screen, which I'm not showing here, basically saying, hey, I was not able to engage. Maybe it was green, maybe it was blue because you were ready to go. And then you kind of started leaving your lane or you weren't properly set up. If you were to press the button at that point, it would say like, no, sorry, I did not take control from you. So it's very clear as to who's driving, which we think is really important, because we want to have no confusion about that. So you'd be in manual, and then you'd be driving, you know, maybe 28 miles, something like that. And then at some point, you're reaching your exit, or there's requiring attention. And we're thinking, kind of warning you somewhere, you know, 30 seconds at a time, saying like, hey, you have an exit coming up, it's half a mile ahead. This allows you to prepare for driving. Meanwhile, as you're driving there, it's hard to see there, but the line, the curve road is showing you which lane you're in, where the vehicles are around you, so you can kind of glance and say like, okay, here's what's happening. In this 30 seconds, you can kind of regain consciousness of what's happening around you. If you should do not engage in that, you get a stiffer warning 10 seconds into it of saying, hey, you know, please turn off auto drive. And you can turn it off by basically just grabbing the steering wheel, pressing the brake, pressing the gas, or turning the off button. And then if you don't have that, then you have another 10-second warning after that that basically says, like, hey, you need to turn it off right now. And then should you not respond to that, you get an even more annoying red warning.
When you say grab the steering wheel, what is sense of the difference between what it's and what you're actually
It does, yeah. So there's kind of four, there's one way to engage, which is you have to press the on button when it's in blue. And for disengaging, you can either press the button to turn it off, you know, just like you would anything else, or you could grab the steering wheel and change lanes. Maybe the car, you had to set the destination to go Tahoe and you need to exit now to go on, you know, 84, and you want to just grab the wheel and just take over control. As soon as it senses that you're overriding it, it will lead back control to you and let you know that you're back in track to drive. Same thing for the accelerator and the brake. And should you not do that, the vehicle will come to a safe stop. So, great questions. I'm trying here. So, the kind of what's our perspective on how we've been thinking about this? So really, what we wanted to look at was thinking not about how can we make today's cars a little bit better, right? How can we make the fuel efficiency higher? How can we make the commutes a little bit easier for you? We really want to think about, like, what would happen if the computer had been invented before the car? Meaning, you know, like, imagine if there was 100 years of computers engineering before the first vehicle was ever built. I feel like cars would be fundamentally different than the way they are today. And if you look at that, you know, think of it how computing power has been accelerating. You know, this is standard plots, basically. Moore's law is kind of from the 50s on out. And then this trend is this is a log plot, right? So any linear line shows an exponential growth. This is actually a curve, which means it's an accelerating exponential. So you can imagine effectively that the rate of computing power you have is accelerating faster and faster, which basically means it doesn't matter that the vehicle was invented 100 years before the computer. Computers are catching up much, much faster. So why don't we start thinking about now what would vehicles be like if they were because basically that's what will be happening soon. Why we do this Google. Google's company is wonderful. We have some of the best engineers in the world. We love to work on solutions that have a huge impact to humanity. And we love solving technical problems. So wherever there's got an intersection of those two criteria is where your problems are really drive us and we want to work on. So I'll tell you a little bit specifically on how the car works. So when the car boots up, it's kind of like in the matrix. It's like, hey, I'm here, where is the metal ceiling? And then we load up kind of a Google Maps Plus. So this is kind of thinking about super high resolution of what the world looks like. This allows us to know where, what the world looks like, so we can position ourselves as exactly as possible. And on top of that, it's hard to see in here, it's a little bit bright, but we overlay very lane level details, like where the crosswalks are, where are the, you know, here's a railroad crossing, there are traffic lights, there are, merges, and so from that, it tells the vehicle, it helps it cheat effectively a little bit. It's hard for the vehicle to scan the world and then automatically parse and say, ooh, there's three lanes, I'm in lane two, where there's a merge here, here's the traffic light. By having this through cache, we can compare what we're seeing now to what the real world was before, identify differences, and from there, have it be able to understand the world more precisely than it would if it had to learn on its own.
So where's the top of the data for the street lines, the crosswalks?
It's collected from previous drives of the car, and then it's processed both automatically and manually in order to kind of digitize the data. So you can digitize it by scanning it, and then you kind of reason about it, and you turn it into a map by adding the features.
Okay. How much do you have to design it?
How much do you reside in the car and how much people? Everything that we need for driving resides in the car. But you don't necessarily need the entire US to drive from here to San Francisco. And so you can load only the local region if you want to, but everything that you need is on the vehicle. So there's no need to be connected to the data center. Now, before you can drive automatically, or when you first booted up the car, we always want you to connect to the data center in order to verify the latest software, the latest maps. We think that's really important because you don't want to be running a car and it's got two-year-old software or something like that, and two-year-old maps. There's a lot of things that can change between now and then. So then we take the sensor data and we kind of process that, and then we reason about it and draw these kind of boxes, which is estimates of what we see the vehicles and what we think they're going. So think of it as we see the vehicle in front of us, we see the vehicle in front of it, we have velocities for both of them, and then we can estimate from there what's happening around us and then kind of tie them to certain lanes. So the velocity of our vehicle might be different if they're going straight or if they're going on a curved road. That's really important to kind of know the difference. And from that, we can reason and say, hey, we're going down, this is Gaster Street, but if we're going down towards 101, you can actually go and think and say, okay, my destination's over here, there's a vehicle that's in front of me, it's going 20, I'm going 25, I need to slow down to match that. But the vehicle in front of it's going 10, so I actually need to slow down even more because I need to match that 10 mile an hour that's in a little bit of the future. In fact, I need to slow down even more because the light's red up ahead, which is why they start to slow down. So you can kind of have a smoother kind of driving experience by taking all these facts into it. And then we just take that and push it to the vehicle for driving, brake, gas, and steering. I'll show a little video here. So this is kind of driving down Shoreline at Amphitheater. Amphitheater, no, this is Shoreline. No, this is Ringsdorf and Shoreline in Mountain View. And as you're driving here, you see there's cars parked to the side. That's not that intersection. This is a different intersection. We're looking to make a left turn, which is where this green light is indicating. The yellow dots are showing the things that are sticking out of the ground. The pink box is showing how we identify them. We saw that vehicle was turning, we turn, these little blue boxes around the yellow dots are representing pedestrians that are in the crosswalk. We're kind of identifying them, these kind of stragglers comes in. We're holding that fence and we let them clear, and then we'll go ahead and drive through and let that happen. So this was totally autonomous. It wasn't unmanned, there were people inside the vehicle. Like I mentioned before, in our training pipeline, there's a safety driver, a person that's behind the wheel, his sole job is to make sure nothing happens. It's more than exciting. And there's a co-pilot, which effectively is looking at what the computer is seeing to make sure the computer is thinking the right thing. And so with those two people, we safely test this type of software. For me, this is a personal story. This is my son, Alex. He was almost never born because his mom got in a car accident when she was 9 months pregnant. So thank you to you for that. And it's up for making very good crash worthiness, but at the end of the day, it should have never really happened. We have technology today that could have avoided this, and I don't think 10 years from now, these crashes will be much more rare. From that, this is one of my favorite quotes from GM, with their executive research, who stated that for some of the customers, it was driving that was a distraction, not doing other things. And in fact, This is real. This is a picture of our home on 880 North. I don't know what he's thinking, but effectively the people are more and more living in their cars, and it's really changing how people are. Right.
So, how do you deal with exceptions? Like, does it turn back control, an alarm pulling back control to the driver? Like emergency vehicles, oversized loads. People that illegally carry a whole tree trunk on their vehicle and stuff.
So how does it deal with exceptions? So there's differences between kind of all the examples. So let's just take a couple of them. So you have, for instance, an oversized load. So this is a vehicle that's wider than the lane. Because we're scanning with laser and camera and radar the vehicles, we estimate their width, their length, their angle, and their speed. And from there, we actually can determine that they're wider than a normal vehicle. And therefore, we don't drive the center of the lane, we offset ourselves enough to be able to drive around them. Or if they're so wide that we can't pass, we just treat it as somebody blocking our lane. So I think it handles those kinds of exceptions very well. Things that we still have a hard time on, things like emergency vehicles. Right now, we have people in the vehicle, we can have rules, like policies, like if there's an emergency vehicle passing, regardless of whether the car can handle it or not, we always disengage the system by default. But you're right, things that we need to do is be able to hear the vehicle coming, which is something that I think we'll do in the near future. And we need to see them coming forward as well as in the rear. processing hand signals, you know, like a traffic cop, you know, at amphitheater when there's a concert and he's like waving everybody by. And, you know, that's not something that computers can do today reliably. You know, so there's a long way to improve in order to be able to handle all these kinds of things.
How does Egypt left turn is marked in circles? Is that a rule?
That's fairly long time ago. I just keep reusing the video because it's pretty easy to understand. So you're saying that the left turn we make was a circle. It's a little bit more complicated. It's not just a pure cross section of a circle. And you know that changes based on the geometry and whether the vehicle's on there. So don't read too much into the fact that it looked like a circle on screen. That's not necessarily what you're doing.
You just mentioned that your car are not even possible with the car. And I'm just curious, how big is your big data? And what is the latency and throughput of your system under normal driving conditions?
So, so how big is there our big data and what's the latency on remote processing it? So there's data that's on the vehicle in terms of like what the map looks like for the what we need to drive. And the data that we bring in real time and comparing those two. The amount of data that needs to compare in real time is only the stuff that you can see, so it's not that big of a comparison. It's maybe a couple hundred meters in front and on the sides. I don't really know what that would be like, but it's kind of like high resolution aerial imagery, so think of that, maybe a couple of megabytes, you know, a little bit more than that. How much of that you have depends on how far you intend to drive, so that could be several gigabytes, you know. And then how fast you're saying at this point?
Yeah, latency and throughput.
Yeah, so I don't really have a metric for your latency, so I'll tell you that you know, we use a desktop class computer for doing the processing here. The latency is not something, so we've checked that, it's not something we really disclose or we have about, but it's you know faster than what a person can do. Now we can't do as intuitive of things, like reading that the person is kind of waving you know, to the side. But we can process things much quicker, like how fast does the angle of the car change, which allow you to do more subtle clues, like, oh, this person is going to get into my lane, I need to open up the space and they're going to confirm.
So right now, you know, most high-end cars actually, if we do manual driving, they are in-car GPS system telling us, you know, like 1 or 2 miles away, there are traffic jam.
Yeah.
And we're gonna, you know, also the system suggests a, you know, optimal route for us to conquer. But if your car, you just told me that it only schedule just you know 15 meters, half mile or you know or even less than half mile.
Yeah, they need to say like that. So it's
less smart or intelligent than you know manual driving.
Yeah, so I would say that that's the only data we use. That's the kind of the high resolution data we use. Is only around the area that we can see now, and then as you move 1 meter forward, you add 1 meter over. But the sensors can't see further than that, so it doesn't really matter if you load 500 miles in the direction. You can't really compare that. Now, for planning and other things like this, then you can load as far as you want because it's very light data. So it's kind of like which lane has how much traffic. It's a kilobyte, a mile of information. So for that, you can see for, you know very far behind. And we do that if you're trying to route to a specific destination. So if you're in Mountain View, you're in San Francisco, you're going to have the whole route above, and you can pull, you know, Google Maps, like, it tells you how long the traffic's going to be. You can use all that information. It's just not very different from a self-driving car than it is for you as a regular manual car. You know, the thing that's different about a self-driving car is that it needs to scan the world, digitize it, and then reason about it in order to be able to drive, and that's only necessary, you know, beyond the horizon that you need to drive. We plan several hundred meters ahead of where the vehicle will drive in case, you know, something is going on.
The interesting thing is if you look like, if you look at like airplane,
yeah.
If some airplane like a fighter or you know, fighter jet actually, they receive radar signal from, you know, other plane. You know. So in that case, they can, actually, plane can watch even further. So in that case, my question is, how about in that case, if your car can accept more, I mean, can receive more signal information but further away, how about what is the obstacle you don't, you know, allow cloud to talk with your car?
So something else, so you're saying like, can we see more if we can use another vehicle's sensors to see further ahead? I totally agree with you, we should, you know, that's something that would be necessary. There's just not that many vehicles out there that they're very rarely, you know, close enough that it's useful. you might have a vehicle in San Francisco and one in Mountain View. That's not very useful for them to exchange information. But if they're going in the same direction, you might want to change, exchange that information. But we also, this is kind of coming back to the chicken and egg issue of not requiring infrastructure or not requiring other vehicles to have that around you. So we want to make sure that every vehicle has everything that they need to drive baked into it, so that nothing is required. Because in your case, if you require another vehicle to see in front of it in order to be able to drive, then how are you driving in the first place when there's no other vehicles in front of you giving you that extra information? So we want to make sure that what we need to drive is present in every single vehicle, and sharing the information between them could happen, but it's not so much a requirement.
Good comment. I think the point is, sorry about
that. No, thank you.
The point is, whether your car, you care about global picture or local picture, or you care both.
Both.
It's just both, you need to talk with the cloud. Because in your data center, they are infinitely computational power. And in that case, you can build much more intelligent,
Airplane. Yeah, sure. So the I think we do care about the global picture as well as the local picture. It's just that we want the local picture to be processed locally on the machine, because it can't rely on a network connection, because network connections go down all the time. So you can't have that latency or the risk of having it. But you're right that we do want to have the global picture be able to affect how you want to drive around. We just don't use it the same way in a, how does it actually the steering? It's more of this thinking about, like, do you want to be in lane one or lane two or lane two?
So what happens if you're going to the city and you decide midway that the city can go over?
So you would, reroute your destination, and then depending on where you are, it might take you on E4, N2, Bay Bridge. And maybe on traffic, it might be easier for you to turn around and go back, or maybe easier to take N2. But that's kind of a global optimization you would do, mid-route, but it's not relevant to driving safely, on 101. You need to do that regardless of where your destination is. Does that answer your question?
But so you're going to get a bunch of new data being done for
So I'm not saying that you need to stream the data so you only have present on you like the next 10 meters of driving. You can load all of the Bay Area, right? You can load, so I don't want to give you the impression that you have a very small amount, like the cache of local data that's relevant to you is very small. It could be all the roads that you've ever driven before, plus, places that you might go because you they're interesting places like Napa, you've never been to Napa. So, and I'm not trying to say like you need to sync, but you're not going to load New York City data when you're in San Francisco because that's too far away to go.
How do you
give
if you have more than one car, how do you take advantage of, you have a perfect map of the world and then instructions out there. So you want to be able to unexpected level of traffic, maybe a car can report that back to a Google data center. Do you even have that kind of
So think of it as you have a copy of the map of the world on your car, and you're constantly comparing to what the world looks like. When you detect that something is different, that's interesting, and that is then flagged and logged and then synchronized up, so that the next person that comes back later on can use that version when they're coming through and understand the difference. Now, there's always going to be a first person coming up upon the construction zone, so you have to have the software be able to handle the driving in that specific zone, like the lanes are created and shifted over, there's a sweeping truck, there's a bunch of different things that can happen, and so it's important that the technology can drive safely through that, but it's not necessarily, the first person going through doesn't necessarily need to have the same smooth experience as the next person. So maybe your first time the person is going through construction, they might say, hey, prepare to drive the manual if needed, and maybe you might need to drive a manual for a couple hundred meters while you go through the construction zone, but then the next person coming behind you has that new information and you can go
there. How many cars are you on the road now?
There are a couple of them. The latest is like half a million, about 1 million kilometers.
This is all nice and good as long as you're all Google, but the idea that Ford, Chrysler, GM, or whatever would adopt Google. They've never adopted anybody else's stuff before. What happens when you've got a Google car meeting, a Ford car meeting, a GM car?
That happens every day. So I think that the point, the way we've been designing technology is that we don't rely on this kind of chicken and egg issue. If you have a car, I have a car, we can both connect to each other. If I have a car by myself, I can just drive around everybody else's car. So right now, you know, the vehicles around us, we don't differentiate like what kind of brand it is. Like we follow a Nissan car, just as you know, well as we follow a Ford car. You can imagine in the future, as lots of people start putting these systems on, it might be advantageous to kind of exchange information or have a better global view. But I don't think that it's necessarily required that everybody has the same kind of systems. Like, go ahead.
You just said something. You said people putting these systems on, are these going to be retrofittable?
Well, that's how we use today. But I'm saying the...
Hopefully without the periscope, right?
Sure, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. We managed to make a little bit more idea. But think of it as, when I say people putting these systems on, whether it's the engineer at Nissan or Toyota or Ford that decides to add that feature to their vehicle, that's what I mean by people putting things on. I'm not saying you go to Best Buy, new stereo, and you have a new vehicle. How the technology gets to market, I think, is still something that is open, and we're not ready to talk about that yet.
What would you do when the weather is bad and it's snowing or fogged up or something, your laser does not work?
You move from California.
Boston.
So that's what we're going to do. Luckily, we currently have clouds here in California, but the thought is it's important to be able to have the system operate safely. And so you need to have, before the system can engage, it needs to know that it can drive safely. And then it needs to be able to transition safely back either to stop or to manual driving as the weather gets worse. Okay, it's fairly rare that, in fact, I don't know if it exists, that you would go from sunny day to all of a sudden such heavy snow that you can't see any ground in front of you. So it happens kind of gradually, and from there you can kind of detect it, say, like, hey, something's up. You're back to drive.
Can I address one thing that is an issue also with autopilots? Is the concept of this handoff to a human. There are two issues. One, the human may not be watching when he needs to be handed off to because he's been lulled into sleep because he hasn't had to do anything. The second actually important issue is if he hasn't done much driving in the last couple of years, he may not even be very good at it, let alone being in an emergency situation. So this interaction between automation and human is a real issue.
So I think that's one of the things that we really care about and we want to make sure that it is done properly. And so the way you're describing that is kind of the system saying, I'm driving, and then say, oops, I'm broken, you're driving. And if that transition is happening in 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, it's not realistic to expect that somebody can re-engage in active driving in half a second. Right? So there needs to be a transition time. And the whole point of this is you need to bake in technology that can drive in a huge number of conditions, in order to be able to give you that bridge. Right now, we're thinking 30 seconds, 10 seconds to slow down. There's a bunch of, when I communicate a number here, but I think there's a lot of thought that goes into this, but it's never, ooh, I have a problem, I'm kicking out right now, which is a kind of a fail-safe type mentality where the system detects that they're broken, turns off, and if you're driving right away. That doesn't make sense here because you could be on a curve. Maybe you're paying attention still, but you're on a curve, and then all of a sudden the car steering, gives up on you, or the auto-driving gives up on you, and you start going on the tangent of the curve. It takes you 2 seconds to come back on and re-engage with the driving. That's actually not a realistic thing that you can do. So you have to give people time to be able to look up, put down the phone, whatever else they were doing, put your hand on the wheel, understand what's going on, and then disengage the system and drive. That, describing that took 10 seconds. Right? That's the kind of imagine you can amount of time that you might imagine people needing in order to go from automatic to manual.
How about the second half of the fact that the drivers are no longer competent? That would be directly analogous to, say, a recent accident at SFO.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. So I'm not going to speculate on how that would, but like, say, so to me, the I don't know how good you get at driving by doing bumper to bumper traffic for an hour every day. Potentially here, what you might have is you might drive only when it's interesting or fun to you. And so it's almost like riding a bike. You don't do it every day. You get back on. It's pretty easy to do. The driver skills atrophying is a big concern. We don't really have real data yet on this because we've driven half a million miles. There's never been a person that hasn't driven for a long time and had to drive. But it's something that we care about a lot.
Yep.
Quick question for you. Is the Google car able to operate in co-pilot mode where, or is there a user interface issue when the car operates in co-pilot mode?
What's a co-pilot mode?
Basically, the car is driving, the car is monitoring how you drive. And if you're about to do something extremely bad idea.
Yeah. Sure. So you're saying like active safety as opposed to self-driving. So early on, we decided not to do that because the thought there is if you experience the car driving for you, you know, better than, I'm not saying better than you, but definitely better than me, on the highway, you would kind of say, like, hey, this thing can really do it. And so we completely disabled the functionality, you know, then, because we wouldn't want to have people get the expectation that maybe we'll just warn you when, you know, we want to know that when the system is engaged, it is driving, and it will do it so safely. But when you're driving, it's up to you. You know, so there could be other applications. The car may have, you know, intermittent collision braking. It may have a bunch of other safety features, but we don't think that the safety features of the driving aspect can kick in because we have a bunch of criteria where you can't just ask a self-driving car to drive anywhere or at any time. It has to warm up and get ready. And so the fact it's not always available would lead to somebody maybe actually thinking that they might be safe, they might drive more risky. So we chose not to do that.
Tesla's Elon Musk saying that a couple of days ago that 90% of the car will go to driverless car. So given the trend, if that's true, would Google get into car business or Google will open source?
We're not ready to talk about
that.
Sorry. Evasive maneuvers, yeah. So we do constant defensive driving. So what I'm talking about here is as we're driving, we're constantly looking for blind spots. So as we're driving similar speeds to other vehicles, we'll naturally tend to drive out of the blind spots in order to minimize the amount of time that we spend in risky situations. As we're driving around, you know, if you're going northbound on 1, there's a truck in lane 3 and you're in lane 2, and there's nobody in the carpool lane next to you, you're not going to drive the center of the lane, but you're going to kind of scoot over to the side and give them more. So these are kind of passive evasive maneuvers. As somebody in front of you, you know, cuts you off or slows down abruptly, we will slow down and make an evasive maneuver. You know, are we going to make a lane change and kind of pull off to the side of the road? That's not something that we do today. You know, we would expect to slow down and get as far out of the way as possible.
I'm curious, what's your next slide?
It's kind of a fun slide, actually. So I'm going to tell you a little bit how I got here. I love the question, but so I don't know how we're here on time.
No worries.
Okay, so I'll just go to the next slide. Keep your question. Is it relevant to this or no?
To the trumpet lane.
Okay. What is it, Greg?
Actually, it's one of the objectives to reduce traffic.
I think we want to. So sure. The idea is it's more. We want to understand how to make the you know, how to improve people's lives by, you know, transforming mobility. You know, so in the future, like, traffic is not something that people like. Traffic should go away. It's not a core aspect of what we want to do. We want to understand how to make technology drive cars better than people. And with that, we think a lot of benefits will happen. Like, you want local parking, you know, you won't have to have, you know, have traffic on the way to work, you'll have time to do other things. So, not directly, but in general. So my next slide, thank you. It's kind of fun, so I'll show you how I got started. So, you know, thanks to Martin. This is the Ghost Rider, so I'm a tenacious person. I try to make a motorcycle work. It eventually worked. There's so much line in the job as it is, but it took us about 600 kind of crashes for learning and understanding the mechanics and the subtleties of the interacting of the ground to the actual driving itself. So, you know, I ended up driving about, you know, 20 miles was kind of the longest stretch that I did without crashing. So this is kind of fun. I love debugging and things in weird areas. What's that? Yeah. So this is kind of testing agriculture. So like, you know, debugging things in weird places. You know, I worked on Street View and you get kind of, you know, weird, unexpected problems like birds making this and places. So this is just kind of like, you know, like, things need to be fun. You need to work on things that are dear to your heart. But at the same time, it's important to have, keep in mind, like, what is the real goal? And, you know, that was a great question. It was just 2-3 slides back. You know, if you take a look at the real world, and you look at, you know, there's about 10 million crashes a year that are just unreported to police, right? You know, about 6 million of those you report to insurance, but there's 5.3 million, you know, crashes by the police. So that's 15 million collisions every year. That's just in the U.S., which is astronomical. 2 million of those have injuries, which is also astronomical. And so if you look at it, like, let's look at kind of the different criteria. This is data from Ron Medford, who is our director of safety, who's kind of really been a huge force on the team to understand what the opportunities are of the technology. Think of it as looking at the different types of problems that people do. So if you look at distracted driving, you have 3,000 people that die because they were distracted. That's pretty shocking too. Drowsiness, 1,500. Pedestrians, 4,000. You know, cyclists, you know, 600. So these are like really, really important. If you kind of plot this out and you look at how many people die every year in the U.S. on the roads, you know, over time. So the great news is we're trending down. Great job, you know. The bad news is they intersect with the x-axis is probably, you know, right here, which, you know, I say it's 2075 is when there will be no fatalities, you know, at the current rate that we're doing. And so that's where we really need to look at, like, what are the causes of this? You know, 85% of the accidents are certified to be driver error. And they think that up to 95% could be a driver mistake, which is a huge opportunity. We're not in building bigger airbags or you know, better crumple zones. We're helping them, but like, we're not addressing the root cause. And the root cause is that people are fundamentally good at driving, but not good enough. And so, you know, if we look at that, out of the 32,000 people that died in 2012, 54% of them had no seatbelts on. So that's an easy, achievable, just click it. So that would be a fantastic thing. Sorry, question?
The previous slide, is that a prediction of when? That could be a prediction of technology getting better. So could that predict when the driverless car actually gets into operation, which is 2075?
I'm pretty sure. I'll go record that it's going to happen before that. That's a pretty easy thing to do. Maybe there's no more non-self-driving cars in 2075. But that's so far out that it's... I can make any kind of prediction. You guys are never going to call me up and say, you were wrong. You're 10 years out to make predictions. Because
so I would say that Asimov made the prediction in 1956 in a story called Sally. That in 2056, the cars are talking in graveyards and saying, people still thought in 2020 that there were better drivers than us. So
that is a pretty smart guy. I think you might be close on the number. So no seatbelts, that's kind of shocking. So let's talk about congestion, which is another thing you talk about. You've got, again, you have almost 3 billion gallons of fuel. You know, $4 a gallon is, that's a lot of money, just kind of lit on fire and burnt up in traffic. 5 million hours of flight would be lost. That's a lot of time people could be playing Angry Birds. $120 billion of fuel on time savings, if you know this. This is not 101, but sometimes it does look like this. And so, you know, let's look at also people, you know, the aging population. You know, 65 and up. Today, or a couple years ago, 41 million. 2030, 72 million. That's almost doubling in that population. And people living longer, that's great. We're making great improvements in medicines, and I think people will continue to live longer. But for the elderly, losing their driver's license is actually a fairly life-changing event. This is a picture of a lady who had just passed her driver's license, who had just passed her driver test that she had been required to do, which meant that she could keep her car, and you can see the smile on her face. She was really excited because this meant that she can stay at her home, she doesn't have to, you know, go live in a group home. Like, this is just, it's a life-changing event for these people, and I think that's this kind of technology actually has a huge impact. You know, even though they don't drive as much, they don't, you know, contribute as much to congestion or to traffic, but then it's actually a pretty important part of their lives to be able to stay in their home in order to be able to get access to the car. And same thing for the disabled. So 56 million people are disabled in the US, and of those, 46% work. So that means they need to get to work, which is actually a very challenging part. And so we had this Marco Miller and Steve Ann. He's the CEO of Santa Clara Center for the Mind. We had him use a car for a couple weeks and understood how much of a life change that was for him. And it basically took his two and a half hour drive into work and back from work, you know, taking paratransit to public transit to Western Connection and everything else, and then back in the afternoon to, you know, 45 minutes of driving from Morgan Hill to Santa Clara. And for him, that's a life-changing event because he's that much more productive. He has that much more time to focus on things that he needs to. And he could also ask his family to take him to work and back, but that's such a burden on their family that it doesn't make sense. And he chose not to do that by taking public transportation. But this has the potential to make, you know, our life better, but also this, you know, the people that are less fortunate than us, lives much better.
But you said you need credit for a driver.
So that's for testing. So for testing, we have, you know, we require a safety driver, which is the last seat, and a co-driver in the right seat. One of them, you know, drives and monitors the driving of the car, the other one monitors the kind of like the computer's thinking. That's because we're testing the technology. We're trying to say, how does this technology get implemented in the real world? We're not going to ship, you know, two Google employees, but with every single system.
So in your world, there is no manual driving, also your green, blue, only green.
Yeah, so our thought is, so it's not so much that there's different points of time. So right now we're testing the technology and seeing what we can do. Like our goal, and we say this sometimes before, is that we want to be able to build technology that drives better than people, and it does so all the time. So we'd love to have on your phone, you go to the front of the restaurants, you know, some California street driver is busy, can't find parking, you get out, you lock it, it drives off and parks itself somewhere else. When you're done with, you know, lunch, you can call it, it comes to you, you get in, maybe your stomach's full, you're feeling a little sleepy, you get in the back seat, you send it home, and it will take you, you know, or take you to work, and for your fresh and ready to work by the time you get there. But the goal really is to be able to build a car that can drive better than people can, so that there's no real need to have people to do it. You can still drive if you want to, but you don't have to park.
Those are all ideal numbers. I mean, what is the end game? We all know it's kind of like real times. When do you think that will happen? And what's the acceptance rate that you have for people?
So, oddly enough, nearly everybody, I would say almost everybody that's been in the car is blown away by it, and they want it. They don't even know how good it is, right? They just, after experiencing it, it's a natural reaction to say you want to have this. So I'm not super worried about the public at large saying, I don't want this technology. I think you need to have early adopters that can, you know, be brave enough to come try it out and then say, hey, this is something that's really amazing. We want to try it. You know, we're going to have a wealth of safety information about the technology before it comes out so that we can, you know, show that it's safe. You know, we have a little saying at Google, you know, in God we trust, all of those bring data. So we will bring data to this problem to showcase to you, not just that in your 10-minute drive it felt safer, it's actually safer, you know, overall. And we've said, you know, we're bringing this, you know, this technology should be available in less than 5 years, about a year ago. So we're 1 year into the 5-year time frame, so you know, 4 years is kind of the clock.
Ideal for one more years.
So what do you mean by ideal?
The ideal of is that you said we could say, you know, all the injuries and everything. All of that, you will reach those 2 million mark within the next 4 years.
No, so I'm not saying that in 4 years, you know, the 2 million injuries are going to go away. I'm saying in 4 years, we'll be committed to having kind of the first one come on. Yeah. I love it if everybody in America, you know, insisted on having this, you know, from day one, and we just make 300 million of them and some magical factory on the backside of the moon that you guys don't know about yet. Just kind of but, you know, effectively, it's going to take a long time to penetrate. The question is really, when did the first one come in, and how is it accepted by the public? And so that's what we're doing.
How many is the team?
It's several dozen. We don't really find it more than that.
Is Sebastian still working
at the point? He is, yes. Yeah. Yes. Go ahead.
Can you comment to the current, and give any indication of the current performance of the system in terms of, if I would use this for real-world driving, let's say from here to San Francisco, like how often like how many times a week or per commute do I have to intervene because I still need to do something versus, no, it's going to be weeks before you really only the emergency vehicle.
Yeah, we talked about it today, we just didn't have the number, so you know, I can't share you with that, but it gets better every day. So it's a, continuously improving, and there's a specific
goal.
We need to show that it's safer than the person before it will be released. So that's kind of
DSRC, is this
using? DSRC, sure. You know, it's another sensor. That would be a great way to find, you know, there's a gentleman that asked, like, are you going to track the vehicles here? That'd be a great way to know where the other vehicles are. You know, we can't rely on it. You know, it doesn't exist today. You know, we don't have it on a car. You know, our car can work completely without it. But effectively, it's just a question of, you know, why would we not use it if it was available?
Are you already working on it?
I'm sorry?
Are you already working on it, doing some research on it?
No, I mean, we bought a radio, we just don't have any other vehicles to talk to get it, so it's more than that. I mean, we'd love to use it, it's just that there's nothing that we can use for it.
How much redundancy is built into your system to get confirmation from what you're seeing or what you're doing?
Yeah, so part of getting the reliability to come up is you know, improving the software and technology, but also making redundancy. And so we have this concept of going from fail safe to fail operational, meaning that no single point failure or relating failure will be able to take a system down. And what that means, we're not ready to talk about yet, but we really think it's really important that you know, the vehicles be a little bit different than they are today. You know, that's kind of part of how our thinking is. That's why we can put sensors that you wouldn't normally put on the car. That's why we're, you know, we're thinking what's next as opposed to how do you adapt it to the thing.
Yeah, so for your sensor that you're relying on, what is the resolution of your sensor, and could it pick out, like, because I know on the freeway sometimes some trucks drive with some poles in the back with only a flag on it as a warning. Now, could the car figure out the bounding box of that pole associated with that truck when it makes a turn?
Yeah, it's surprisingly good at seeing things, you know, like that. Now, I'm sure there's some special cases you could cook, you know, cook up that you couldn't handle, you know, right away. But in all the driving we've done, we've seen a lot of interesting things. You know, the pole or the flag, even if the pole or the flag wasn't there because the flag came off, we're getting so many different, like, looks at the vehicle that you may not get it every single time, but as you get it once, twice, you can understand that the vehicle was this long, and all of a sudden it came a little bit longer again. Like, there's something sticking out, so now you can extend the model of the vehicle as it's larger. And then as you're tracking, you know, some features on the vehicle, you can understand that it's actually longer than what you're seeing because you've sensed that before. So that's not really, I can't tell you it sees a cubic millimeter, you know, of the voxel of the whole world, but it's fairly good at doing things like what you're describing there. So the map is used a little bit as cheat that they started on kind of how to process the real world. It's not so much that the accuracy is important because we don't really drive a lap long coordinates the way Caltrans is kind of builds a road or a survey of you. You really need to drive what you're seeing in the real world in real time. The map just helps you say pretty what it should look like. Based on what you're seeing now, what's the difference that you're seeing? So the resolution is more of an important question than the accuracy. The accuracy almost doesn't matter because you're going to drive what's around you. And the resolution is basically driven by how precisely you want the vehicle to do. So today, 10 centimeters is roughly what we need to drive.
What do you reference?
We try to reference everything, right? So from side of the road, you know, buildings, trees, paint, concrete, everything is part of anything that the sensor sees that it's going to see again is something that you may want to use. So.
What about driving underground or in the tunnel?
Sure. So, like I was saying, like the accuracy doesn't matter. So, we don't kind of rely on GPS in terms of we need to know GPS so that you know where you are roughly. But as you're comparing yourself to the map, you can figure out where you are on that map. And then from there, whether the map is, you know, the lower deck of the Bay Bridge or a parking lot somewhere, it's kind of a continuous structure that you can keep navigating within. So as you're moving forward, you see, like, you know, you're a level 2, and you go down one level, you're a level 3, even though you haven't had any GPS in the last, you know, 10 minutes or so, you don't need that GPS bar. You just need to know where you are in the reference of the world and what you said.
I'm just curious if you can speak a little bit to your metrics and how you know you're doing better this month than the last month.
Yeah, so we track, you know, so it's not fair to look at like crashes as a metric because it shouldn't happen, and just because it didn't happen doesn't mean that you're safe. So you need to kind of take a precursor metric to that. So you can break things down as to how good are people driving. I mean, there's no real good industry standard, which I think is something that really is missing. But you can look at things like how close are you to the vehicle in front of you in terms of TTC or time to collision. Basically saying the vehicle in front of you is going 65, you're going 65, you're 10 meters away, your TTC is infinity because you're diving. They slow down, they start to go 64, 63, 60, you're still going 65, you know, there's a 5 mile an hour difference, that means there's a 5 mile an hour closing speed. How many seconds, if you had not done anything, do you have a buffer before that collision happened? So that's one metric. And you can add accelerations, you can complicate that as much as you want, but that's one specific measure. And if you look at, you know, that metric, for example, you can graph all of, you can do a cumulative distribution function saying how much time you spend in every single second in the hole from 0 to, you know, 20 seconds or more, and then say, well, it doesn't really matter on the high side because if you're 20 seconds away from a collision, you're always 20 seconds away from a collision and something where you go wrong. So things that are close are important. And if you look at like less than 2 seconds, you know, we're probably spending less time in that than our manual drivers are doing by a factor of 5. So that doesn't mean that the vehicle is 5 times less likely to get in a collision. It just means that on that specific metric, the vehicle is actually spending 5 times as less of the time in that kind of risky state. And if you can start doing this for a bunch of states, like lateral and, you know, for, you know, unexpected events, you get a feeling for how the car is expected to perform in these circumstances, and that's really how you want to go forward.
As a driver, you need to be able to read. Can the system read?
It's hard to say. Somebody answered yes and no. Like, we can, we don't do OCR on signs, but you can understand what the sign says. Because, you know, lane closed ahead is always on that diagonal, and they always said lane closed ahead. So you can match that pattern and understand that it's a lane closed ahead sign. But it doesn't necessarily, you know, maybe they misspell a word in a letter in that, we're not going to detect the misspelling. We'll just still say, like, hey, this looks still like lane closed ahead. We can process that information. You know, same thing for speed limits. It's OCRing and saying, no, 25 is, it looks more like a 25 than a 35 to me. But it's not really reading the 25 sign. It's kind of pattern matching. Is that?
Yeah, sure. But there are also displays and there are lots of information you're going to need. And it's real.
Sure. There's not a lot of displays, specifically in the US, like this lane is 70 kilometer per hour instead of being the 120 that it normally is. But usually systems that have displays also have an external feed, and then you just pull the external feed. It's way easier to get the data visually over the internet than it is to try to read the lights in there. One of the DSRC things that we'd be really excited about is actually traffic lights, because right now we do it with cameras. We verify across a bunch of different traffic lights, but it'd still be nicer to have a radio connection to it than not. So, yeah.
To come back to 5 years, a feasible product for 4 years from now. In the world, we need a program manager for that product. What is the milestones? What has it happened?
Well, we have to demonstrate that the product is safe.
Could you repeat the question?
Sure. So the question is, what are the milestones to happen before launch? Is that fair?
Yeah, in 4 years.
Yeah, in 4 years. We would need to demonstrate that the technology is superior to human driving, and demonstrate a business case, find partners, convince the public that this is something that they want, convince the legislative and regulatory authorities that this is something that they want as well. You know, I can't tell you specifically, I need to show 500 million miles of driving in simulation and 2 million in the real world. And there's no, these are just made up numbers. There's no, I'm not ready to share that level of granularity right now.
And then
what we, and then everybody wants to line up at the store, at the beginning, all the way to the Apple store. Sorry, and then there's what we're doing, but
it's not the consumer product. It's
So there's a bunch of certifications that need to be achieved. What it means to be a consumer product is the expectation is to make millions of them, because it's a consumer product. I don't think that when this comes out, it's going to come out in a million a year type of volume. I think it'd be much more limited than that. I'm trying to get that, if you can be more specific about your question, I think maybe answer it better. I just don't understand what you mean by and then.
But maybe the definition of the consumer product is not the problem. I think the consumer product is a competitive
product. Yeah, also, a consumer product is a car you can buy as a consumer. Yeah, so I don't think that's necessarily what we mean by the technology will come be available. We just mean that is when we expect people to be able to experience it. So it's not that you're going to buy a car or you're going to buy the technology. Think of it more as technology is ready for you to experience.
All right. Okay.
Is Google, what are Google's plans? Are you planning on getting into the automotive market or are you planning on software?
We don't really have, I'm not ready to talk about that, but that's not. That's what we're good at today. What's my next slide? Okay. Thank you. So expectations, which is kind of some of the people hitting at this, is are these cars going to be 100% effective? Will there never be another crash in the world? The answer is no. There will continue to be crashes. There will continue to be bad things to happen. But will it be better? Can we make an improvement? That's really what we're focusing on. If you look at seatbelts, which are amazing, I encourage everybody to use them. Are only 45 to 50% effective for the front seat. They saved 273,000 lives, which is pretty awesome, since the 75 when they were mandated. Child seats, 71% effective for kids and for infants, and 50% for toddlers. They saved 9,000 lives. Frontal airbags, 14% effective. They saved 35,000 lives. ESC. Something that nobody really understands, it's a kind of a magical technology, and it's one of the things that Ron was responsible for making mandatory and one of his great achievements at NHTSA, is for single vehicle fatalities, 49% effective, 72% effective when the first crash event was a rollover. And they're going to require us this 2011. That's amazing, 72% effective, as I said, in reducing crashes. This is a magic technology. Because you didn't even know you had it. It just makes you a better driver when you need to make a better driver. Which brings you back to when somebody asked a question like, could this technology be activated when you were driving only? Today we say no. In the future, if we can have a 72% effectiveness, it makes perfect sense to kind of do it. We're just very cautious and we want to do it very carefully so that we maximize the safety potential without opening up any risks. So here's my last slide. Thank you. Basically, our goal is that we want to improve people's lives by transforming their so I'll take questions.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So that was your last slide. I thought you better ask this question because you put this fantastic slide up there at the beginning and said, what if we invented a computer before the car and how we can change everything? But then I kept waiting for the punchline because all of the rest of it seemed to be how to improve people's existing experience of driving their own personally owned four-wheel Prius. Nothing against Prius or something else, but if we're really rethinking everything from scratch, what about vehicle architecture? What about mobility as a service? What about a whole host of things that could really be unlocked for a service like this? And I'm sure that you've thought about it, so I'm just trying to probe to see what your thoughts are.
I think that's the space that potential partners would be really excellent at. We feel that we're very strong on the technology side, and we bring that to the market or to the party. Kind of the audience question here was what happens when it's a consumer product? I think that there needs to be a lot of things like that that come from potential other partners. I don't think that this is something that on its own can be as effective as if it was embraced by the established players.
So in your photo of
Steve
Mahan, is that the same?
Steve Mahan, yeah.
There's a camera pointing at him. Is that part of the usual system?
It's not. It's just because we were recording video to make him if you check out YouTube video, you'll see why it's there. It's just because we wanted to film his experience of going to dry cleaners and getting a taco and just living life normally.
So the user interface right now is really this, the system is on, off, and then it's the usual instrument panel. The pilot is looking at message log from the computer, or the co-pilot, I'm sorry, but the driver is just seeing on, off, plus the usual driver control system. Is that right?
Do you want to answer that question?
Yes. Anthony actually stopped by with the vehicle recently at Velodyne, and I was actually surprised when he opened the door. He almost didn't even see that it's a self-driving car. Obviously, he's seen the sensor, and he's seen a couple of sensors in the front, but inside it's amazingly clean. I was expecting to see a bunch of computers and cables and all kinds of equipment. It's all nicely packaged away. I mean, the car looks, when you open the door, it looks like a normal Lexus.
Thank you.
So,
are you
talking about cost?
Yeah, it's extremely expensive. It's not at a point where it is a consumer product. It's at a point where we're showing that the technology is capable of doing it, and there's a long way to making it reliable as well as affordable.
Is that part of the four-year program, or
no?
What do you think?
So, just quickly, if you have a question, can you wait till you get a microphone so we can...
I have the first answer.
All right.
Yeah, just talking about it.
Okay, all right. My question was that you mentioned before that car needs to turn and go over to 30 seconds, 20 seconds, 10 seconds. And then the last meter was the red box. So what's happened after the red? Like, you don't do any more?
Yeah, so if you had a heart attack or something like that, and you're not able to do it, we want to bring the vehicle to a safe stop. Could be side of the road, could be left side of the road, depends on what the circumstances are. It's can't describe all the specific things, but the idea is that we can't just let the system turn off. You have to bring, because you were given the responsibility of driving, you need to keep that responsibility of driving until either it's handed back to someone or you brought the vehicle to a safe position. Could be side of the road, it could be the next exit, it could be a garage, 2 miles up. Depends on what the system can do.
What are the unsolved technical challenges that you can do in the next 4 years?
I think that the reliability is probably the biggest challenge. We want to make this system as reliable as possible. And so getting that is really important. Being able to deal with unexpected events is also a very big aspect. So dropping the couch or the barbecue on the highway is a pretty big, it's an event that's pretty traumatic for people to drive, but it's also traumatic for self-driving cars to have. And
what about the flying newspaper?
That's actually pretty easy. We can kind of handle that now because it's not connected to the ground, so we can see it as flying and stuff like that. So that's pretty good.
Are you planning on taking the Velodyne off eventually, or is that something that's a permanent sensor that you're going to go all the way?
You wouldn't know that it wasn't a self-driving car if we didn't have that.
The discussion of LiDAR as a main sensor or camera as a main sensor, what's your take?
There's different religions of opinions and engineers of us, which one's better. Right now we're using all the sensors that we can to understand what the limitations are of each and how much we can do with all of them. We think that to make the car reliable the way we do today, that we use the sensor that's there, and it's been great, and it's allowed us to do what we've done so far. So I don't think it's appropriate on a Ferrari or a Porsche or something, because it's kind of detracts from the lines. I'm sure they're working on something new. I'm sure that a lot of people are looking in this space. Lasers are a fantastic sensor because you're able to see things that you can't with the camera. But humans can drive with only one eye, so it should be possible at some point. So it's just a question of how good the engineering could be going. We need to drive things.
So we have the microphone here.
So far you've
taking the approach of retrofitting existing vehicles with this suite of sensors and computing power and whatnot. And you can argue that you could scale that up a bit. And you can also argue that in the long run, that the present architecture of cars, of self or non-self human-driven cars, isn't optimized for a self-driven control system. There's a lot of safety equipment, all these things that probably won't be needed in the future. What, in your view, at least in the near term, let's say Gen 1 of the mass production vehicles, what in the existing car architecture do you think needs to change first in order to allow that self-driving control system?
I think that the first thing you need to change is not removing safety features. Like you're saying, you could save, you know, X numbers of dollars by not having airbags because you're never going to crash. That's not really what the goal is, because you're still going to crash. The question is really, how do you make the system able to operate reliably? And, you know, things like redundancy are really important, and having kind of fail operational safety systems. So today, you know, you can put a DVD in a navigation system and install, you know, malware that will disable the brakes. That's not okay. You can have power steering failure, and the person mechanically has to steer the wheel. That's not okay. You need to have these systems be, you know, reliable, the same level as you would have, you know, flight control surfaces on the airplane. They need to be, you know, cross-validated, whether it's two motors or two controllers or double bound or whatever's going on in the industry. That needs to be kind of a high reliability functionality. Same thing with the brakes. You know, the reason we have two lines of the master cylinder is because at some point somebody realized that you didn't want to have only one, you know, hydraulic way to brake your vehicle. And then people went to ESC and ABS, where each line is independent of the wheel, and so it doesn't really matter if the lines from the master cylinder were there. So improvements are constantly happening there. Fail operational of the kind of drive-by-wire platform of the vehicle is really what's missing to bring the technology to work.
So
hypothetically speaking, if the commercialization path is to partner with automakers, and with all due respect to some of the folks in the audience, the conversation may be going at a pace that is not equivalent to Silicon Valley pace. Would Google consider, we are in Silicon Valley, would Google consider supporting, funding, getting 10 startups just so get it done instead of waiting?
I'm not going to speak on Google behalf, yeah. Just to make sure we're very clear about the answer. I don't think that the solution to getting kind of fail operational race is to do 10 startups to kind of try different flavors for it. Right. I think it's really about figuring out how to get the platforms that, you know, need to occur for the technology to be ready. It's closer to people that are, it's a business decision today why you're going redundant in power steering.
And no, I'm looking for, I'm actually literally saying fund 10 new types of OEMs with different vehicle architectures to commercialize the technology in a different path.
Yeah, I don't think that's realistic. You were one of those companies that were helping to get funding.
No. We're doing just fine.
So here is the mic for now.
Two questions. One question is that in the event of unpredictable equipment failure, such as like sudden acceleration, what can Google Car handle? And second question is that for America, that car kind of became a second home, and then people really respect the privacy per se, and say, but now I can see that you can even remote control a Google Car, right? And what can you do a particular measure to prevent it being hacked or being really big brother over you over time?
So I'm not going to talk about like the big brother stuff in general, but like the there are many cars that are online today, and vulnerabilities, you know, exist and have been demonstrated. And there's papers out there that you can see where you can remotely disable brakes on certain vehicles by hacking into their, you know, telematic system. You know, Google's a technology company. You know, we're online 24/7. We face a lot of attacks, and so we have a lot of really good tools in order to prevent. We have security reviews. We take security we call security, a lot of people call it cybersecurity, but we take that very seriously. We have extensive ways of minimizing the both the attack surfaces that are possible and also having different layers of protection so that we are actually, should something bad go wrong, you can't keep going onto the vehicle. But the best way to go about this is to constantly iterate and make sure that you have software that is up to date and then reviewed by the best engineers we can.
Okay, just one more question from Dean, and we better wrap up.
Thanks. Multi-part question, if I may. First part, I take it from the way the strategy of self-driving cars, you first sense the world around you, determine the hazards, and then you figure out a path you want to go, generate a path, and then control the vehicle's path. Those algorithms that control the vehicle, figure out the trajectory generation, deterministic or non-deterministic approach?
Deterministic.
Okay. Second part question. Earlier you mentioned about the redundancy, fail-safe, the operational. I take it right now you guys are currently working towards or have already working towards making it similar to aircraft, like triple redundant, double redundant actuator sensors.
I'm not saying that we're working on that. I'm saying like that's the kind of expectation that you would expect to have on an existing power steering system that is as fail operational. You know, basically means like there's a failure that happens. You can detect that, but you can still operate the vehicle in order to bring it to a safe stop. You know, the safe stop for an airplane means landing. You know, safe stop for a vehicle may just mean pull to the side of the road or take the next exit, which is much less time and the same granularity of control.
Okay. Okay.
Wondering if the price point you're selling the first car.
I don't know.
You didn't answer my first question.
Greg, we have one more question. He's been waiting for a while, so we'll let him ask the question, and then we'll shut it off.
All right.
Thank you.
Just two quick questions.
No!
Just one.
You give him a mic, and that's all he's going to do.
Which OS or programming language are you using to this technology? I don't know if I've been in your channel or built from the ground up.
It's mainly
C++. C++ on Unix or Linux or
on Chrome.
It's on Linux. It's a Linux space.
Linux space. Yeah.
Linux.
Thank you.
Okay. Some round of applause for everyone.